Okay. Hi. Good evening. My name's Holly. Jasmine asked me if I would share this week while she's in Florida with Cheryl. And I know Jasmine's style, and I am by no means Jasmine, so I hope you guys had coffee because she keeps you awake by her energy, and I hope you guys will stay awake for the teaching. But yes, there's candy. I'm bribing all of you with candy so you guys will like me more. But I just to give you a very short bio myself. I worked under Jasmine in Murrieta for a year while she was the dean out there, and then she went on the mission field in London, and then I eventually became the dean and worked up there for a couple years, and then moved down here in June of last year, and then have started working at the Bible College as the registrar in February of this year. So there's kind of a very, obviously not my bio, but a very brief understanding of how I'm here tonight. And I had the opportunity of teaching missionary biographies last spring, so a year ago in Murrieta, but I didn't teach on Elizabeth Elliot. So that's who I'm teaching on tonight is Elizabeth Elliot, and I was really excited to teach on her because she's a very well-known name to most of us, I don't think. Is there anyone who hasn't heard of her or know? Is there anyone who doesn't know, like, a bit about her story? No, you guys all, so maybe one of you guys. Yeah, I feel like she's still alive today, which is kind of an interesting thing. So I know a lot of the missionaries you guys have studied and heard about are not living any longer, and so she's a much different one than some of the ones you've heard of. And I think if you've ever spent any time reading her books, she has so many books. She has a lot on missions, and she has a lot that are not on missions. So if you guys ever have a chance to read any of her books, read them, because she's a really, she's very good at writing, and just her perspective, I think, that she writes from is really refreshing, I think, to a lot of us. So if you guys ever get a chance to see any of them, read them. I have tons in my office. I have, like, a good majority of her books. So if you guys ever want to borrow one, feel free to come in and borrow it. But I think as a woman, she kind of like disciples you as you read, and that's kind of was a sweet thing. So not saying she's not for guys at all, because she is, and she's written a ton of books about missions that are applicable to everyone, but she's also written some that I just feel like the way that she writes is like very discipling, which is a sweet thing about her. So before I get into her story, before I keep talking, let's pray, and then we'll get going. Lord, thank you so much for your goodness to all of us. Thank you that you're here with us tonight. Thank you that you dwell amongst us and that we can look to you, Lord, for our strength and our sufficiency. Thank you for the good things you're doing in every one of our lives, and we don't get a chance to share and to know, but Lord, you're overall and you're working in us all, and I thank you for that, because as we hear someone's testimony, Lord, we know you're giving us all one and you're writing our stories, God, and we pray that our stories would be used to glorify you to a great in a great way, Lord. So I pray tonight as we share on Elizabeth that you would be amongst the teaching, God, that is the truths that were seen in her life by your grace, God, would be exemplified, Lord, in order for us to draw closer to you and for us to learn to trust you more in the details of our lives that we need help with, Lord. So we love you, we thank you, and go before us this evening and go before us in all things. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so Miss Elizabeth Elliot was not born Elizabeth Elliot. She was born Elizabeth Howard, December 21st, 1926. She was born in Brussels, Belgium. So she was born internationally, and she was born to her parents, who were missionary parents, and they worked with a part of something called the Belgian Gospel Mission. And so she was born to a family of six. She had four brothers and two sisters. So a very large family she was born into. And when she was only a few months old, her whole family moved back to the States. So they were only missionaries with her. She was only a missionary as a child for only a few months. So basically not at all, because she probably didn't experience much of the culture there. But she came, they moved to Philadelphia. After a couple years, they ended up moving to New Jersey, where she spent most of her childhood. She went to public school for most of her life, but in 1941, she enrolled herself in Christian boarding school in Florida. So she left home in 1941 to go to a Christian boarding school in Florida and spent her high school years there. In 1944, she graduated from college, and she enrolled in Wheaton College. She graduated from high school, and she went to Wheaton College in Illinois. Have you guys heard of Wheaton? Is it? Okay. Awesome. Yeah, it's a very notable school. So, but she went to Wheaton College herself. So she decided to go to Wheaton, and her major was Greek. And she really wanted to focus on linguistics because she wanted to be a Bible translator on the mission field. So that was her heart from a young child, and that was something that she wanted to be trained in so that she could go and be of much service on the field wherever that happened to be. So while she was in college, she was involved in journalism and as an editorial writer for the student paper. She was also a member of the debate team, and with her help, they won in 1947 a national championship, which I think is kind of notable for her. It shows something of her ability in debate to be able to do that. The same year was when she met Jim Elliot. Have you all heard of Jim Elliot as well? I feel like they're obviously Elizabeth Elliot, Jim Elliot. They're very one and the same. But so is that year she met Jim Elliot, and her brother was really good friends with him. And so that Christmas of her first year in college, he asked if she would come. He asked if Jim would come home with them for Christmas. So he was able to spend that first year at Christmas with her family, getting to know them and getting to know her as well. So a lot of her writings in this beginning part are from her book Passion and Purity, so I apologize if there's a lot of focus on their relationship, but I feel like in communicating her, when you teach on someone's life and you read writings that they have opportunity to write, and a lot of it focuses on a certain point, I feel like there's value there. And so I know maybe as far as her mission life, this is early on, but I feel like this is a huge focus of her life, and I think obviously, her relationship with Jim and what they went to do on the mission field was a huge part of the beginning stages of her missions and how God worked. So part of it, I think, is just focusing on how the Lord did a lot of things in their lives together and how he works in our lives as well. So I feel like it's important, although the beginning stages isn't quite missions work yet. It's just them and the formation and what God is doing in them. But if you guys ever have read that book or want to read it, it's a story about her and Jim's relationship mainly, and then a story about relationships as a whole. They deal with a lot of issues, and she has people write in that she writes their letters in there that are just about relationships. And although she wrote it probably 70s or 80s, it's still very applicable. And me going through it again for this class, I was amazed at how many things were important and I felt like valuable to learn from. So her and Jim were completely opposite. Jim was outgoing, he was social, he was a part of a wrestling team, and Elizabeth was the exact opposite. She was shy, she was quiet, she was not in any way a part of the social crowd. She was into journalism and writing. Like, her interests and his interests were complete opposites. But that did not keep them. So she got to know him. She really struggled with her growing desire for him. So she got to know Jim better and see certain aspects about him that she really liked. She struggled because she really began to like him. And I think her struggle wasn't only because she didn't see any response from him, but she struggled with the idea of, does God have me be married or does God have me be single? She knew she had a desire for marriage, but she also wanted to not just pursue things because she had a desire for it. She wanted to make sure she was pursuing things because it was something that God desired for her. And that was a huge thing. So she wondered, did she want what she wanted or did she want what God wanted, no matter what the cost? So this just shows a beginning of her character early on to kind of see how the lens was that she was viewing life. And because she wrote so much, there's going to be a lot of times I can personally quote from her, which is kind of an opportunity that we all have because we can really hear from her and what she wrote instead of, having it all just be summarized. So here's one of the first quotes I'll say. Until the will... Okay, so this is about her and Jim's relationship early on while she's just trying to, like, function and figure out what is... what this relationship is and what God has for it. She said, until the will and affections are brought under the authority of Christ, we have not begun to understand, let alone accept, his lordship. The cross, as it enters the love life, will reveal the heart's truth. My heart, I knew, would forever be a lonely hunter unless settled where true joys are to be found. So I think that last part is important because she realized that although she pursued her own heart's love, she realized my heart's always going to be lonely unless it's settled where true joys are to be found. So she realized, God, my heart has to first be found in you before I'm ever going to be found loving someone else and finding myself content in their love. It has to first be in your love. So weekly, Jim and Elizabeth did evangelism. So they would go out to different places, and they were part of an evangelism team. So they began to spend a lot of time serving together that built into a huge part of their relationship of getting to know each other. So she continued to struggle with her feelings, and she's very honest about it in her book about all the inward thoughts that she went through. But part of it was also because she didn't see any response on Jim's behalf. So she was not only trying to keep herself because does God have this, but she was also trying to keep herself because if this man who she's beginning to like does not respond, she doesn't want to just be entertaining thoughts towards him that aren't ever going to be reciprocated. So one evening they were at like a picnic and he was hanging out with some of his friends and she was helping clean up. And before they left that night, he went over to her and he said, "Hey, do you mind if I walk you home?" And she was like, "Sure, you can walk me home." So as he walks her home, it's okay. As he walks her home, he said he wanted to clarify how they felt about each other. And I quote, she goes, "Feel about each other?" And he said, "Come on, Bet, don't tell me you didn't know I was in love with you." And her response was, "I had no idea." So he obviously was very good at hiding his feelings, wherever they were in his heart, or he obviously wasn't someone that wore his heart on his sleeves, as some of us are accused of doing. But so during that talk, as he told her that and obviously opened her eyes to the feelings he had for her, he also told her that he knew God was calling him to be single. So that's quite an interesting contrast in their life. You'd probably be wondering, why are you telling me this then? But he said, this is what he said. He said, "I'm called to be single, perhaps for life, or perhaps only until he had firsthand experience with jungle missions." So he knew God had called him to be a missionary. He'd heard many people saying there's work to be done on the mission field with single men. And he took first his calling from the Lord to be a missionary before he wanted to put forth his calling or his desires to be married. And so he thought, I don't know how to combine these two, but I do know God's called me to be a missionary, and there's work to be done for single men. So he took that seriously. He told her, "If I marry, I know who it'll be. That is, of course, if she'll have me." So he's like, "I know I'm going to marry you if I'm going to marry, if you'll have me." So that's quite an interesting situation you're putting a girl in. But he also told her he wasn't asking her to marry him. He couldn't ask her to commit herself to anything. He couldn't even ask her to wait. So he's saying nothing. He's not saying anything. He's just saying, "I'm in love with you and I can't do anything about it." He said he'd given his feelings over to God and God will have to work it out if he wants it to happen. So Elizabeth admitted in her book that she said, "I wondered, could God even work this out?" Like, you know, in her heart, there's this like doubt towards God. Like, "God, is this even something that you can work out?" But at the same time, she was thankful that she had a man that put God first above everything else. So there was this contrast in her mind, like, gosh, this is such a difficulty. But at the same time, I love that he puts God first, and that's a really important thing to her. So at this time, they began to pray steadily and wait patiently until God made the way plain. Elizabeth quotes, "Patient waiting," or Elizabeth says, I quote, "Patient waiting does not come naturally to most of us, but a great deal is said about it in the Bible. It's an important discipline for anyone who wants to learn to trust." So waiting is not only a huge part of Elizabeth and Jim's life and Elizabeth's life as a whole, waiting's a part of all of our lives, and I think we're going to have a chance to learn a little bit about what that looks like through her biography. Waiting silently is the hardest thing of all, but the things we feel most deeply about when we ought to learn to be silent about, we ought to learn to be silent about, at least until we have talked them over thoroughly with God. So she knew that she couldn't just start talking to everyone about her feelings until she first sought God and sought, "What do you have for this situation?" So in the spring of 1948, she graduated from Wheaton College and she went up to Canada to do an additional year of Bible college. So she was just going to do directly Bible college in Canada. And Jim still had another year at Wheaton that he was going to finish up. So during that time of waiting, she writes in Passion and Purity, "When the will of God crosses the will of man, somebody has to die. Life requires countless little deaths, occasions where we are given the chance to say no to self and yes to God. There is a big however. It is this: we are not meant to die merely in order to be dead. We die in order to live. A seed falls into the dark earth and dies. Out of its death comes multiplied life." Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. I think that's pretty a very powerful one. And she's very poetic in how she writes. So you guys hear it as I communicate her quote. She's very poetic in how she communicates things. So she admitted that she struggled much with loneliness during this time. She said it was a really hard time for her. She said she found herself asking God, has he cheated her? She said she would see other people going out on dates and doing different things. And she said she felt in her heart, have you just cheated me? And she said she was embarrassed and surprised. She was humiliated and surprised by these temptations that she faced. And so it was embarrassing to her to say, I'm even doubting God. Like, I know the character of God, but I'm doubting him. And that was that surprised her and humiliated her. So she obviously had never felt those sort of intense temptations to doubt God and his character ever before in her life. So as she experienced him for the first time, she was very like, this is humbling that I even feel this way, that I even feel so strongly towards this. But she said she learned in this moment that power comes to its full strength in weakness. So as she was weak, she began to learn the power is not of her, but the power is of God. And that's an important lesson for her life. Her prayer was this: for my loneliness, Lord, your strength. For my temptation to self-pity, Lord, your strength. For my longings for this man, Lord, your strength. So in 1948, their paths crossed again. And when they passed this time, Jim told her, he said, we can start correspondence. So up until that time that she graduated college and went to Canada, they had no correspondence. There was silence between them because he didn't feel like that was going to be good for them to continue to communicate if there wasn't knowledge of where the future was going. So this time he sees her and he says, hey, I feel like God's giving us an open door that we can have correspondence. So sweet, they can start writing letters. But he says, however, there's no more clarity from that point on. Like, I'm not saying we can be married. I'm not saying anything else. And I want us to be careful that our desires for each other never outgrow our desires for the Lord. And so while we're in this time of corresponding, I don't want it to grow to any place that it shouldn't. We need to constantly be checking ourselves. And there was even a time, I think, the first letter they wrote that he said to her, like he asked her directly, like, is your heart growing more towards me than it is to God? I want to make sure I'm safeguarding you to the Lord, not just doing what I want with you. So he was careful with that. But in the second letter he wrote to her once they began correspondence, he said it was a decided no. So he said he got word from the Lord. It was an absolute no that they were to be married. And he said at least as long as the current situation prevails. So as long as the situation of him being called to be a single missionary prevailed, marriage was not an option. However, he felt okay to be corresponding to her. He said if it happened to change, he would let her know, but there was no conditions at that time. So in 1949, she graduates from Bible college in Canada. He graduates from Wheaton, Illinois. He goes home to Portland. Jim was from Portland. And on her way home from Canada, she decided to stop by and visit him in Portland and meet his family. So they had a chance to be together for a little bit of time, and they went to different gospel meetings and missionary meetings and in their time together and just got to enjoy time together. And both of them, obviously, clearly, like, we can let the weight of it set in. Like, they're enjoying this relationship that's building. They're enjoying both of their desires and aspirations for future ministry and missions. And at the same time, they're at a continual conflict of saying, our minds can't really go beyond the situation that is. And sometimes I think that's the biggest struggle. Not that you're like, I'm not okay with a no. It's just sometimes your mind wants to be able to figure out your life. And when you can't, you're like, I'm kind of at a standstill. And I think that's what they are facing. So when she came home to visit, he wrote her a letter. And he said to her, what God is doing, I cannot say, but this I know, he has led us together. But still there was waiting. So he's not sure what the future holds, but right now, I know, I like that I see looks on your faces are like, oh, like it's painful, because it is, it's painful. I want to be like critical of him, but I know that there's no way. And she's so sweet. I love the way that she writes, because she's not critical of him at all. She doesn't once communicate any bit of like criticism towards him. There was one incident that happened that I'll tell you guys about later. Actually, no, it happened before this. It was really interesting. So they kept themselves very pure from one another. I think when he said goodbye to her at the airport, the most that they did was like he clasped her hand and like shook her hand to say goodbye. That was all he did. And so he wrote her later and said that he'd kissed another girl. And she was like, okay, how is this happening? Like, you've kissed another girl. No, she didn't think that. She said he was very regretful that he had done that. And he was like, you know, saying, not only have I dishonored you, I've also dishonored the glory of God. But she was nothing but understanding. She's like, I understand that we guard more carefully those relationships that are more important to us than we sometimes guard those relationships that don't mean anything to us. And she goes, like, she took such a mature approach, and she goes, I know that we're all sinners. So for me to expect that there wouldn't be error on his behalf would be silly. And I'm sure if he didn't care about it and he was being ridiculous, she wouldn't have the same response. But the fact that he was repentive and sincere allowed her to have that response. So in anything, she wasn't critical of him, which is very honorable, because over the course of it, I've grown to be like, come on, Jim, not critical of him, but just like, just do it. But that was not her heart, so I won't display that either. I'll keep myself from it. So a year later, she saw him on her way to Canada. She was going back up to Canada, and he was in Illinois for her brother's wedding. He ended up being the best man in her brother's wedding, and she got to see him. But from that point on, it was still another year till she was able to see him again. So in 1951, him and a friend, Pete Fleming. Have you guys heard of Pete Fleming? He was another guy that was a part of the mission that all the men did, and we'll go into that later. But
it was in our reading for this week.
It was? Okay, was this whole story?
Not the relationship part.
But the men. Okay, good, good. That's actually good because I didn't go into too much detail, obviously briefly, but I didn't want to go into too much detail because the story's on Elizabeth, not on Jim. But so he travels through, they're going to go speak at churches, and they're going to try to talk to churches to raise missionary support now that they know that they're going to go onto the mission field. And so him and Pete come, and they're spending all this time over on the East Coast traveling, and they get to spend a lot of time together. So as he's preparing to go out into the mission field, they're being able to spend time together and continue to cultivate whatever relationship this is that they have. And they got to see each other much, but still there was nothing. There was still no green light, and he was clear about that. It was still just waiting. So there's a quote by T.C. Upham that she said was her favorite quote during this time. And it said, "The disposition to leave the dearest objects of our hearts in the sublime keeping of the general and unspecific belief that God is now answering our prayers in his own time and way and in the best manner involves a present process of inward crucifixion, which is obviously unfavorable to the growth and even to the existence of the life of self." Do you want me to read it again, or is that, it's kind of like a heavy, not heavy, but it's like a wordy quote. Do you guys want me to say it again, or is it like, one more time, okay. "The disposition to leave the dearest objects of our hearts in the sublime keeping of the general and unspecific belief that God is now answering our prayers in his own time and way and in the best manner involves a present process of inward crucifixion, which is obviously unfavorable to the growth and even the existence of the life of self. So there's a continual death that we have to do to our self life if we are going to allow God to do things in his way and in his time. So that year, Jim was able to vacation with her family, so they spent a lot of time together with them before he went out to the mission field. In January of 1952, Jim was in Portland. He was preparing to leave for Ecuador. That's where he had opportunity to go and to begin work. And then she was in Brooklyn. She ended up getting an apartment in Brooklyn, and she was learning Spanish for her trip out to Ecuador as well. She knew that she was going to go to Ecuador, and she knew that there was going to be criticism on her because in some ways it could have looked like she was following him, but she was like, I have to let that go. I know I'm going to Ecuador. I know God has called me to Ecuador, so I'm going, and she was trying to prepare by finishing up becoming fluent in Spanish before she could go. At the end of February of 1952, Jim arrived in Quito, Ecuador. That's where they all started their mission station. 2 months later, Elizabeth followed. So at this time, she was able to live right across the street from him. So for the first time in 4 years, they had that, like, since college, they had that close of relationship where they could see each other daily, they got to experience life together, and the bonus was they both were there to learn Spanish so that they could go out and to work in the jungles somewhere in Ecuador. So she had a roommate, her name was Dorothy, and Jim had a roommate, and his name was Pete Fleming. So Jim and Pete ended up going down there together, and Dorothy and Elizabeth went down there together. So at this time, there was no decision for them to go out on the mission and work together. It was like, we're both down here, we're at a station, there's a training program going, we're learning the language, and we both want to go out. They're very anxious to go out into any jungle mission field that they can, but at this time, there was no clear open door as to where that was going to be for Elizabeth and Dorothy. Jim and Pete had already had an invitation to go to Shandia, which was a mission state, and work with the Quechua Indians, who I'm sure you guys have heard of or read about this week. So during that time together, they got to spend so much time together and grow even more, and he continued to communicate to her. He felt like God was leading them more and more together, and he felt like God was okay with the potential of them being married. He just didn't know when. So as they grow together, they're seeing a greater understanding of their relationships coming together. I think one of the sweetest things is you see so much connection in their lives as well. Like, there's a huge similarity in their lives, and I'm sure that continued to give him confidence before the Lord, because although we struggle, I think all of us struggle. I struggle on this end reading their story and thinking, my goodness, why is this so difficult? But on their end, you also say that's honorable because they didn't want to just jump into something. They didn't want to be foolish and frivolous. And there's always that contrast of when we're really seeking to do things uprightly before the Lord, sometimes it's a slow and patient process. And other people can look on and be like, what in the world are you doing? But I feel like their hearts, at least, were seeking to honor God. Regardless of, you know what I mean, they could have got married earlier or later, their hearts were so seeking to honor God, and they really wanted to be careful with the mission that he had given them. And I think that's honorable and that's recommendable, because although it seems painful, which it was, they both were learning valuable lessons through this process. So at the end of 6 months, Jim and Pete went to work with us in Shandia with the Quechua Indians, and Elizabeth and Dorothy were still there for another 2 months. And so once again, there's another split without any understanding of what time they're going to be back together again and what is going to happen in the future. So she writes this about the process of plants. She said, the seed falls to the ground and dies. As the new shoot springs up, there must be a splitting and a breaking in order for a bud to form. There's no ongoing spiritual life without this process of letting go. At the precise point where we refuse, growth stops. If we hold tightly to anything given to us, unwilling to let it go when the time comes to let it go, or unwilling to allow it to be used as the giver means it to be used, we stunt growth of the soul. It is easy to mistake here. If God gave it to me, it's mine. I can do what I want with it. No, the truth is that it is ours to thank him for and ours to offer back to him, ours to relinquish, ours to lose, ours to let go of. If we want to find our true selves, if we want real life, if our hearts are set on glory, the more you perceive God's purpose in your life, the less terrible will the losses seem. So I love how honest she is, and I think that's a privilege we have of hearing from her, is that we hear her complete honesty. It's not a glorified story of who this missionary was that was a woman of faith or a man of faith of Jim Elliot. We get to hear the inner processings of her heart and emotions. She deals with real life things that all of us can connect to and relate to, even though the circumstances and the situations are different. It's relatable to us all because we're like, yeah, I've dealt with moments like that. And I've either chosen yes or I've chosen no, and God's had to continue to use those things to like reteach me the lessons of trust and growth and patience and acceptance of his will over ours and all those things. So I really appreciate her honesty because I think it's pretty important. So within a few weeks of Jim's going east, Elizabeth went west. So now there's two Andes mountains that are separating them from each other. She went to work with the Colorado Indians and he went to work with the Quechua Indians. So they're in two separate places, both on different things, not knowing. And they said even, I think mail took like 6 weeks. I think one time she said she sent a letter to him and it took 6 weeks for her to get a response. So maybe she got a letter before then, but the response to the letter he got took 6 weeks from that way to that way. So a long way and not much communication between the two of them. So in amongst the Colorado Indians, there was two women there that were very untrained in linguistics, and so they needed help translating the Colorado language into a written language so they could eventually make it into a Bible, which is the very thing she wanted to do. So her and Dorothy went out there together, and they were stoked on this opportunity. They were like, this is exactly what we planned for. So there's huge opportunity for them to continue to grow in what they planned and studied for, although it wasn't quite yet what, you know what I mean? It wasn't for her an area where she was waiting on, but at the same time, God was being faithful all along to use what she had prepared for and do exactly what she'd wanted, be a part of linguistics and Bible translation. So she went there, and they arrived in September of 1952. That's when my dad was born. They arrived in Colorado, and the whole time she was there, she spent making an alphabet for the Colorado tribe. So she ended up being there a total of 9 months, and her whole time was spent trying to transcribe something from the Colorado language to be able to put it on writing so eventually they could work the word of God into their language. So in 1953, she got a letter from Jim asking her to meet him in Quito, which was the place where they all started. So she went immediately. But to get out of the Colorado, get out of the mountain region, she had to take a horse for half a day, and then she had to take a banana truck. She had to sit in the back of a banana truck for a day to get to Quito. So no travel was easy there whatsoever. So you're stoked, you're anticipating seeing your boyfriend, girlfriend, and you have to take a day and a half just to get there. So there's this long journey of waiting, even in the midst of her just getting to him. So when she got there that night, Jim proposed. So here's the next clincher. They didn't set a wedding date immediately. I'm not laughing when I say this. They didn't set a wedding date immediately because Jim wanted her to become fluent in Quechua before they got married. So that was the one part where I'm like, come on, man. Like, he wants her to be fluent. So he's like, hey, will you marry me? And she's like, yes, I'll marry you. And he's like, okay, well, we can't set a date because I need you to become fluent in the language before I marry you. I mean, so honorable, right? So honorable because he really knows, you know, his calling. He knows what he's doing. And he wants to make sure they're going to be effective and not distracted. Awesome. However, humorous. And I can imagine it's just like this, right? Like you're excited and then you're down. You're excited and you're down just because it's not what we want. It's not what we think we want, you know, but God's will is always better regardless of what we think we want. And I'm sure these people, they were being very prepared for a life of service to him by all these ups and downs, which all of us have and sometimes need to accept more. June 16th, 1953, she finished the alphabet, and even though she was complete with it, she felt guilty. She felt like, man, I'd taken so long to do this. I allowed all these distractions to come in. It was her first experience out there, and she just felt like I could have done it so much faster. nonetheless, she completed it, which was a huge job done. There was a family who lived in the eastern jungle, so closer to Jim, that invited her to come and stay with them and start to learn the Kichwa language. So when she was there, as any of you can imagine, she was like an avid learner. She was like, I think I annoyed the mom as much as I could, because she was always asking, like every day in the kitchen, what is this, what is that, trying to understand it, because she obviously has much motivation to be amongst them, but also to be with Jim as well. So a few weeks after her arrival, so she now gets to this family's house, and she's been there for a little bit. She gets a letter from Dorothy, who was who she worked with amongst the Colorado Indians, and she wrote to tell her that all of the Colorado language that she had been working on had been stolen. All of it. So there was no duplicates, no copies, everything was gone. So now there's this disheartening reality that what she'd spent the last 9 months of her life doing was completely, in a sense, for nothing. So I have a long quote from her, as you can imagine, after she figured out this news. It says, she learned again to be a follower, to be a follower of Christ means. Sooner or later, a personal encounter with the cross, and the cross always entails loss. It is not by any means an easy thing to recognize. Within the given instance of personal loss, the opportunity it affords for participation in Christ's own loss. Certainly, I did not think immediately of my loss of language notes as God's ways of breaking through certain categories of mind. It is hard to infer that our little troubles may actually be the vehicles to bring us to God. Most of us simply grin and bear them, knowing they are the lot of all human beings. We simply cancel them out, none the better for the lessons we might have learned. It was only gradually during the months that followed that I saw that to God nothing is finally lost. Loss and death are only the preludes to gain life. God won't let his work be set back. That he does always and everywhere put a wall around his servants and their service for him. Faith, prayer, and obedience are our requirements. What we are offered has to do with another world altogether. So I like that she says the little troubles that we all face, we can just so easily dismiss. And I think I've heard so many times people being like in traffic and being like, you know, God, you have me in traffic here today. How do you want me to use this? And I'm always like envious of those people, because I'm like, how in the world do you do that? That is never my mind. Like, I spill coffee on myself. I don't think like, wow, this is an opportunity to like go back in the house and maybe take some time longer. I don't know what you have. Like, which I think she's clear that she didn't have that immediately either. But I like that she reminds us of that, because that is by no means my initial instinct. Like, that is not. And so it wasn't hers either, but it was after time that she got to see things play out that she realized, God, these are little things that you have that have been allowed by you. They're not these coincidences. And so it doesn't stop our hearts from being disheartened by things. She still, I'm sure, was very bummed, not only because it was her work, but also because it was something that was done to benefit these people, to get the gospel to them, and now it has to be longer done. She told a story, and I really hope I can remember it. I didn't bring the book, and I brought the other one. But it was a make-believe story, obviously. And it's of, okay, this is what it is. I got it. So it's of Jesus walking with Peter and John. And he tells them we're going to go on a journey for the day. Pick up a stone. So Peter picks up a small stone and John picks up a bigger stone. And they're walking along. 2 hours later, they come and they stop on a hillside. And he says, and they're like famished from their journey. And so he turns their stones into bread. So Peter eats his, and he's still hungry. John eats his, and he shares some with Peter because he has so much to give. And then they start up again, and Jesus says to them again, pick up a rock. So then Peter, this time, as you can imagine, picks up a huge rock, and John picks up a rock as normal. And they walk on another 2 hours, and at the end of it, oh no, I'm going to forget the punchline. Hold on. That's like the worst thing ever. Hold on. Oh, they threw it into the water. Oh my gosh, hold on. That's what it was. This is it. At the end, it is kind of like a drop, but the moral's good. So at the end, they get to a river, and he says, throw the rocks into the river. So that's all they do, is just throw the rocks into the river. And Peter looks at him like so frustrated, like, I have no reward for carrying this big rock the last time. It was this huge reward. And Jesus asks them, for whom did you carry the rock? So the story, you know what I mean? So that he was carrying it for himself instead of thinking, I'm carrying this in obedience to you. And that was a huge lesson she learned in that. Like, my work to the Colorado Indians and doing the alphabet, it should have still been recognized as work to you. Although in the end there was loss. The loss is as I see it. The loss really wasn't to you at all, because who can really thwart the plans of the Lord? So huge lessons learned for her through that and continually through her life, as we can see. So now she's still with the family learning the language, and Jim is still working with the Kichwa Indians. And so he'd been working on a station for 9 months. And in a similar time that that loss happened for her, there was a flood on the station that he'd worked, and it wiped out a lot of the buildings that they'd been spending their time building. And so they'd been working to rebuild. They wanted to make a boys' school and some different buildings for the people, the Kichwa Indians, as they came to know the Lord, to come and be trained in and to have homes, to, or not homes, but buildings to utilize for that. So there was three guys that were part of the mission station down there, and they all agreed at this time, they felt like it was for Jim and Elizabeth to go and rebuild that place. They felt like they were the people to do it. So on October 8th, 1953, they got married in Quito. Yay! It's like what we've all been waiting for, right? So finally, their journey of waiting, their journey of not knowing, their journey of trusting the Lord for his goodness but not seeing how it's going to play out comes to fruition in their marriage. They honeymooned in Panama, and their verse that they were reminded of on their wedding day was Isaiah 25:9. Lo, this is our God. We have waited for him. So they saw how much the waiting wasn't in vain. Although it's not always the end that we think, it's never in vain if we're waiting on the Lord. So it was a huge lesson for them to learn. So 1954, they had a little girl, and her name was Valerie, the only child that they had together. And so as they began to be established amongst the Kichwas in work, they built a school, and they really sought to teach the Kichwa people about the Lord. And they prayed fervently that the Kichwa people would be freed from fears and superstitions that they held through Jesus, because they saw a lot of things that the Kichwa tribe had been influenced by, and a lot, none of it had to do with the freedom that they could have in Christ. But obviously there's a time in order to learn the people to know how to communicate that to them. So because of that, progress for the gospel was really slow in Ecuador. It wasn't a rapid thing where they went and they put a mission station on the ground and many people got saved. It was really slow. So missionaries were working amongst the Jivaros, amongst the Kichwas in the Andes, amongst the Colorados in the western forest. And there was one group in the midst of all that that remained, that had up barriers against the white man, and that was, as you guys all know, the Awaka Indians, which I think are also called the Harani today, because I think Awaka meant savage or something else, killer, and so I think today now they call them the Harani people instead of the Awakas, but in this whole thing I'm going to refer to them as the Awakas. So they were an isolate, unconquered, semi-nomadic remnant of age-old jungle Indians. So Jim and Pete wanted so much to learn as much as they could about these people so that they could eventually have an opportunity to go and be able to preach the gospel to them. And so the first missionaries that went into the Awakas was in 1667, and they were murdered. So the initial people that tried to make contact with them were murdered. There was 200 years of silence from 1667, about 200 years, until 1875, and that was so 200 years of silence that they didn't have any people stepping on their ground. They were alone to do what they wanted. In 1875, rubber hunters came into that region, and they were plundering villages, raping and torturing people. So the Awaka Indians, for whatever reason, they killed these initial missionaries. Then the next view they have of white man is them doing nothing but damage. They're hunting their land, they're plundering villages, they're raping and torturing villages. People, sorry. So it's not a misnomer that these people had no love whatsoever for the white man. Like, there was a clear understanding that they would probably not in any way be favorable towards white men. Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't know it was locked. That presented an even greater challenge to Jim and Pete, because they wanted to know, can Christian love, can the love of Jesus himself be able to break through the memories that these people have of years and years of hatred towards people, and can it break through for salvation? And so instead of it being something that presented fear in their hearts, it was the exact opposite. These men were only driven on to want to go and be a greater part of their lives. And so the Awakas were a mystery to many. And you guys, I don't know how much you read about it. Did you guys read most of this in the book this week?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So you guys know that there's The End of the Spear, a movie also on it. Through the Gates of Splendor was Elizabeth Elliot's book on it that they also made into a movie. So there's a lot out there about this event, which is really neat, because it obviously stirred up a lot of people after they died to go out and share the gospel. And I know you guys have probably heard, especially in this class, but Blood of the Martyrs is the Seed of the Church. Have you guys heard that? So that's such a huge, it's for our minds, our natural minds that struggle with the thought of like, my life is going to be at the cost of something else, it's hard for us. But as our minds get washed by the water of the word, and as we learn, we understand that that's more Christian and more Christ-like, I guess I should say, than we realize. And that's humbling to us all. It's humbling to me because that isn't natural for me. So I'm sorry that if I repeat anything, but I'm just going to keep telling some of the story that I have as it relates to both of them. I did try not to communicate as much about them because their event was obviously the guys and it's on Elizabeth, but just so you know. So they didn't know anything. There was no evidence of why the Iwakas killed. There's no idea if it was so many people just said, oh, they kill for pleasure. They kill because it's because they're born killers. They kill to rob and steal. But there was no single motive. There was no set pattern behind any understanding of why these people killed. And so that just created this intrigue to who these people were. But only one thing was known, and that was white man was unwanted. And anyone who stepped upon that land risked his life. So that was a very clear thing that they all knew. But Pete Fleming and Jim knew that they wanted to reach the Iwakas. So as they began to talk about it, there was five men that you guys know, Pete Fleming, Ed McCauley, Nate Saint, Jim Elliott, and Roger Urien, that ended up being a part of this Operation Iwaka. And it was said in Elizabeth's book that all of them were completely different from personalities, and they were all represented like three different mission stations. There was a lot of difference, but they held one thing in common, and that was the Bible as the literal and supernatural and perfect word from God to man. So I love seeing the unity amongst diversity, because we can get caught up in that, but in a common mission of us bringing the gospel to people that don't know it, I love that there was unity amongst that. So Jim and Elizabeth were the only two in Shandia, and the rest of the they all were husbands, and all of them were fathers except for one, and they all were in different mission stations all around. So 1955, Operation Iwaka began. And so the beginning, as you guys know, they tried to communicate friendly communication to the Iwakas by dropping gifts and trying to just communicate like in anything they knew of their language, like, we're your friend, hi, we're your friend, you know, we like you, all these different things. And they continued to do that. And then the second time that they dropped gifts, they saw the Iwakas go out, and like they went and took the gift from the line that was hung down from the plane that Nate Saint, he was the pilot of the group, flew. So they were like, that's huge. It shows their understanding that we're trying to give them a gift. It's not like going over their heads. They're not just thinking these random things are falling. They understand. And then a couple times later, they tied a headband on it to communicate, like, we're giving you a gift back. So this was huge to the missionaries. They were like, these are signs that we did not think we were going to see maybe for months. And we're seeing this huge communication that they're accepting what we're giving them. So this friendly contact kept up for a while, and exchanges had been given both ways. They kept giving them more things, and they kept having more things being returned to them. So they ended up getting like many things. A parrot was one of them, food, pottery. There was tons of things that they gave them. Oh, they gave them, was it a monkey?
Yeah.
And it got a monkey tail. That's right. What was the thing that died? Oh, two little, there was something, remember, it hit the thing. There was something, and as they were bringing it up, like hit a tree, or it hit the ground hard, and they were landing. And there was two things that they said they think were alive when they gave them to them, but they were dead by the time they got them. I think it was like birds or something, like little birds. I don't know. But so after all this happened, they set January 2nd as the date that they were going to go down to see them and meet them face to face. And so they found a good landing spot, and the plan was for Nate, as you guys all know, to go and kind of round up the village and tell them, Cure, I think it was the Cure River, like, come down there, we're down here. So from the wife's point of view, here's something from Elizabeth. She said, as the men prepared and talked endlessly about Operation Iwaka, the women talked together one night about the possibility of becoming widows. What would they do? God gave them peace of heart and confidence that whatever might happen, his word would hold. We knew that when he putteth forth his sheep, he goeth before them. God's leading was unmistakable up to this point. Each of them knew when they married their husbands that there would never be any question about who came first. God in his work held first place in each life. It was the condition of true discipleship. It became devastatingly meaningful now. It was a time for soul searching, a time for counting the possible cost. They wondered, was it the thrill of adventure that drew our husbands on? No. Their letters and journals made it abundantly clear that these men did not go out to shoot a lion or climb a mountain. Their compulsion was from a different source. Each had made a personal transaction with God, recognizing that he belonged to God, first of all by creation, and secondly by redemption, through the death of his son, Jesus Christ. They knew it was their duty to share this truth, and therefore the question of personal safety was irrelevant. So these wives came to terms with the fact that God is before our husbands, and we are okay with whatever happens, and that's wonderful. So in January, the women helped the men get all their belongings together. And Elizabeth said as she was taking Jim to the plane, she wondered, is this the last time I'm ever going to see him? So they dropped him on the ground, as you guys know, on the one by one on the beach. They made a little makeshift like tree house so they could be up above the ground for any predators, or they said they heard jaguars in the trees, so for different like common things where they would be a clear and open prey. They said they all had guns, which I'm sure you guys know. I think they had guns for protection for themselves. But as you know, they didn't use them. So despite Nate's attempts to rally the Awakas, they sat for 4 days with nothing, just quiet, nothing. They were, you know, kind of thinking, okay, what's happening? Eventually the three came, the guy and two girls came. George, they named the guy. Delilah, they named the girl. I think the other girl, I don't think they named her, but I think she might have left earlier than the other two. They took George up in the airplane. You know, he went and waved to the people down below just to show to the Awakas, to show them, like, he's with us, we're friendly, he likes us, like, we're okay, we're not enemies, we like them, to try in any way they could to, like, communicate this message of, like, we're not here to hurt you, we're here to be your friends and all that. And so then that night, the three went home, or the two went home, and knowing they were like, well, surely they're going to go. They're going to tell them tomorrow. We're going to have the whole group down here. The next day, nothing happened. It wasn't until the following day, Sunday morning, January 8th, that Nate went back to the village to try to stir them up again, and he saw only women and children. So when he saw only women and children, he was like, this is awesome. This must maybe, hopefully, that means a group of men are coming down here to meet us. On his flight back to the Curé River, where the men were on Palm Beach, is what it was called, he saw a group of men walking. And so he was, like, pumped. He's like, this is it. It's happening. So he goes and he lands and he tells it, this is it, guys. Like, they're on their way. Like, it's happening. We're going to meet these guys face to face. The moment that we've been praying for is actually here. So Nate Saint, the pilot, contacted Marge Saint, his wife, at 12:30 that day, telling her the news that the plane had landed. Telling her the news that the guys were coming, and that 4:30 again that day he was going to contact her and let her know how it went. So you guys know what happened on the beach. And do you guys know? Does anyone not know? Okay, so on the beach that day, the men came down. Well, we don't know because there was no writings of it. But what happened was that they ended up all being speared. So we get more information later, but that was this. They basically, all of them, regardless of their seeming friendliness, they were not friendly with them, and all the men ended up being martyrs. So at 4:30 that day, Marge Saint waited by the radio to hear from him, and nothing, obviously, for us, obviously, not for her. So she double-checked her walk to make sure everything was okay. Nate was like a very meticulous man as a pilot. I don't know if they went into much of it in the book, but he was like, you know, he said he'd have his alarm set for a time. So if he was in conversation, his alarm went off. He's like, okay, got to go. Like, that was it. Like, he was on such a strict schedule. So she began to worry, but they didn't want to alert anyone because they feared if they let the word get out that that these men went to the Awaka territory, they would exploit the mission, and it might cause press to get involved with the Awakas. And if anything didn't happen to them, they wanted to preserve this mission to the Awakas for the hopes that the gospel could be reached. So they were like, let's just wait this night out, and we're going to see what happens in the morning. So obviously none of the women slept very well at all that night. All of you are concerned and tossing with the possibilities in your mind. So the next morning at 7 a.m., did you guys hear MAF? Was that in the book? Missions Aviation Fellowship was really big. I think it's still an organization. Really big back then to go in and do different missions like this and drop food off for missionaries and reach, get supplies to people, do evacuations, all that. So they went at 7 a.m. and they flew by the river. And by noon that day, news flashed around the world that five men were missing in Awaka territory. So it didn't take long, rightly so, for the word to get out. But later that day, a pilot flew over and saw smoke in one of the areas, and he kind of got hopes up, like, maybe this means that they're still alive. So he brought back word. So all of them had this weird kind of suspended hope, maybe thinking something was going to happen. But the next day, another flight went out to search, and the news came that a body had been found. So one body had been found on the river, and I think they said it was a white shirt and jeans like he was wearing. And so all the women, I think, knew that it was Roger Urien's wife, or Roger Urien, because that was what his attire was. But they didn't have really clear findings just yet. So it was this weird, like, you know, everyone just kind of like anticipating what's next. Later that day, they found another body, and all of the wives, although they hadn't got word yet and still hoped, they all pretty much came to the understanding that probably all the men were dead. So it wasn't until later that day that it was reported that all men were dead. They found all four of the bodies. The other body that was found by Kichwa Indians, I don't think was ended up being recovered, but they found the four men all together. So it says, the wives, although greatly saddened, had peace with God. For this is our God forever and ever. He will be our God even until death. So they all, when the guys came and told them, they said, we want to know everything. Don't soften the blow. We want to know as much as we can about this attack because we want to be informed about our husband. They didn't want to be kept from it. They were really okay with knowing the full truth. And these women were really one in the same mind with their husbands. They weren't in any way separate from them, you know, in any way down there against what their desires were. They were clear that was what they wanted. One of them wrote a letter to the mission family trying to explain the peace she had. She said, I want to be free from self-pity. It is a tool of Satan to rot away of life. I am sure that this is the perfect will of God. So her husband being taken, she did not want to have self-pity. And she said, I am sure that this is the perfect will of God. I am genuinely challenged by that. So it says, the men were given a burial site on the Kure River. So all of them were buried there. One of the guys that was there at the burial said it was just like an eerie day. Like everything about it was kind of weird. Like as they buried them, like it was like a blustery day. And there's a lot of like haze in the air. And he said everything about it just seemed like a somber day for burial. The wives ended up getting an opportunity after the men were buried to go and view the burial site. They just flew over it. They didn't go down or anything. They just flew over it. And Marge Saint commented, as she looked at it from the plane, she said, that is the most beautiful little cemetery in the world. So these men died doing what they came to do, and they died doing what they knew the Lord had allowed them to do. But the end was an unexpected end that, although there could have been an idea that that was the end, it was in no way, obviously, what anyone's mind thought was going to be the end of this operation. So at this time, there was no ability to know how the men had died, what exactly happened in the final moments, and all the wives could do was speculate. So Elizabeth said there was one thing that they knew. Whomever shall lose his life for the sake of the gospel shall save it. And so there was no question that these men were with Jesus. So all the women had the comfort of knowing that their men were with Jesus and in that they could rest. So letters poured in from all over the world. Obviously, this was, as you guys know, as we all know, it was an international thing that happened. So from Japan and Alaska and China, letters poured in saying that they were being prayed for. And in those moments, the women still prayed and hoped for the salvation of the Awakas, and plans were quickly formulated of how they could continue this operation to continue to reach them. And it said, revenge never crossed the mind of any of the wives. So never once was any of the wives like, we're going to get these people. Like, they knew the hearts that was behind it. And this is by the grace of God, truly. We all have to recognize that. This is what we're witnessing, is the Spirit of God working in people's lives to allow them to have such an outlook that is God-honoring in the midst of this moment. And that is a praise to Him and an honor to these women that allowed the Spirit to have, you know, this influence in their lives. And so it's a beautiful thing. So in the book, it shows what all the wives did. I can read it. It's kind of a little bit, but just so you guys know, from this point, this is what happened. So Barbie Yerdian returned to the work amongst the Havaros with the two little children. Elizabeth went back to Shandia with her 10-month-old now, Valerie, to carry on as much as she could of the work in the Kichwa station. So these women didn't even go home, is what it's basically saying. They didn't fly to the States first. They just went back and went working other places. Another pilot, Hobie Lawrence, and his family and a new plane were sent to the mission air base in Shelmera, while Marge Saint took up a new post in Quito after the birth of her third son, so she was pregnant at the time of the death, in the United States a few weeks after the death of her husband. Mary Lou McCulley returned to Ecuador with her boys to work in Quito with Marge. For Olive Fleming, who had spent only 2 months in the jungle with her husband when her husband died, the problem regarding the future had been more difficult. But for her, as for all, one thing is certain. Her life belongs to God and had her husband's, and He will show the way. So that was what all the women did immediately from afterwards. So Elizabeth goes to Shandia, and she begins to work there again amongst the Quechua tribe, just doing what's the next thing, and I'll tell you that in a minute. Elizabeth said that the death of Jim didn't come as a huge sense of drama for her. The history of missions had repeated itself. She knew stories upon stories of many others who had died due to their conviction to share the Lord with people. She knew that if life was to go on, it needed to go on meaningfully. She knew obedience was necessary, and if obedience was a good reason for dying, it most certainly was a good reason for living. So she'd heard enough stories of missions, she'd become acquainted enough with the fact that martyrdom was a real thing, that it wasn't a drama for her when he died. And I think that is really, to me, shocking. Sure. Elizabeth said that the death of Jim didn't bring on a huge sense of drama for her. The history of missions had repeated itself. She knew stories upon stories of many others who had died due to their conviction to share the Lord with people. She knew that if life was to go on, it needed to go on meaningfully. She knew obedience was necessary, and if obedience was a good reason for dying, it most certainly was a good reason for living. I'm going to let you guys go on a break. It's 8:55. Is it really?
7:55.
That clock is wrong. No, I'm wrong. Reading clocks. So come back. Do you guys want to come back at 8:05? So I'll give you guys 10 minutes, actually 9 minutes, to take a break. And are you enrolled? Are you Ian? Awesome. I just did roll and I wanted to make sure.
My name is Donna.
Donna Smith? Awesome. Okay. Oh, yes, because that's right. All auditors get... For some reason, I was thinking auditors didn't. And Ruby's here. And Arlene's not... Arlene? I'm so sorry. See, I didn't call because it was auditors, so I was thinking that wasn't attendance, but it is. Francesca, let me put pause real quick. Okay. Let us pray again. Lord, as we open up again... Be with us and teach us, and thank you for opportunities that we have, even as Ruby was sharing, to go on the mission field ourselves and give our lives to you in these ways practically, Lord. So I pray that as you continue to challenge us by these people, Lord, stir in us your desires as well, that we would be obedient to what you have in whatever season and whatever that looks like, and allow the lives of these people to challenge us to seek you and to learn to trust you, Lord, in the ways that they showed. So we thank you for who you are. We thank you for your spirit. It's in us, the same spirit that dwelled in all these missionaries that these students have had a chance to learn about, God. And we praise you for that, because we know that you're the one, God, that works these great works, Lord. And we are nothing, God. We are weak, and it's your strength and our weakness that gets the chance to be displayed. So we praise you for that. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so I shared that quote that we read twice about her realizing, like, it was not the hugest shocker to her. Obviously, doesn't mean she accepted it with open arms and would have asked for that, but at the same time, it was something that was a reality to her. So it says she wasn't without the questions of why, but she knew she could live with those questions if she just simply did the next thing. So at this time, she went back to the work in Shandia, which we said... And there was many things that presented themselves to her. So she had much work ahead of her, and that's what she said she did. She just did the next thing. And there was evidence that there was daily faithfulness that was needed. And she felt like, I will continue to know what God has for me if I obey today. And if I just continue along the path of obedience, which he so clearly laid out for her. There's a quote from the book that said, "The word missionary may call to mind preaching, teaching, church building, medical work, baptizing, catechizing, social improvement, I found myself quite unable to undertake any of these activities. A strange position for one who is called a missionary. I began to search my guidebook, with a capital G, the Bible, aka, to learn whether my definition had been an accurate one. The word missionary does not occur in the Bible. The word witness does. I found many passages indicating that I was supposed to be a witness. One in particular arrested me. It stated that to be a witness to God is above all to know, believe, and understand him. All that he asks us to do is but a means to this end. He will go to any lengths to teach us, and his manipulation of the movements of men, awakas, missionaries, whomever, is never accidental. Those movements may be incidental to the one thing towards which he goads, the recognition of Christ." So there was much work for her to do at the mission station in Shandia. There was medical needs of the people. There was her own baby, Valerie, to care for. There was a boys' school to prepare for. There was shepherding amongst a young group of Kichwa Indians. And there was so much that she could have used more help. So she was by no means just sitting around twiddling thumbs, grieving. She had much to do every single day. As we said before, men continued to try to reach the Awakas and just did the same thing that Jim and Pete and Nate did, is just drop gifts down to them, just to try to continue to communicate the word that we want friendly contact with you. We want you to know that we love you. So by no means did that stop. But yet no one was going down to reach them at that time. So in her heart, Elizabeth, she knew she still had a growing desire to reach the Awakas, but she said the way was completely unknown. So all she did is she put herself in God's hand and said, God, if you're willing, I am ready. Like, she clearly saw there's nothing else I can do, but I can pray and say, if you're willing to let this happen, I am totally ready. I am more than willing to go if you present an opportunity. So in May of 1957, Elizabeth got an opportunity to fly over the Awakas and help drop gifts. So that was the first time that she got a chance to be a part of one of these kind of missions. And when she saw them, she said she had a burning desire in them to meet them face to face. And she said, I understood how the men felt so fervently about wanting to get down on the ground, because she said she felt the exact same thing. When she saw them from above, she's like, all I wanted to do was have the opportunity to meet them face to face. But clearly the reality of danger was very evident to her. She by no means was ignorant that these people were dangerous, so she didn't in a moment think, let's prepare a plan. She said the Lord reminded her of the story of Ananias when God told him to go and speak to Saul, even though his reputation was that of a killer of Christians. She knew God made it explicit to Ananias that he would make... She knew because God made it explicit to Ananias, he would make it explicit to her as well. So she didn't doubt God, although there was large fear, there was still a great desire, and she knew God could do that. So around this time, the Awakas had broken into a missionary's home called the Tidmarshes. There was a doctor. Dr. Tidmarsh was down there working in a place called Arahuno. And the Awakas had broken in there. They'd broken the door. They stole stuff, and they just completely destroyed the place. And so it made it even more evident, if anything's going to be done amongst these people, it has to be God, because they're in no way ready, as we would see, for people to come in and start to mingle amongst their tribe. So a month after that attack happened, the same missionary family invited Elizabeth to come down and stay with them. So she knew this was an important decision. She didn't feel like it was just one she could casually answer. She knew there was weight to this decision because she was moving closer to Awaka territory, and she knew there was a lot of things that could present themselves for this. So as she prayed, she felt that there was a strong leading from the Lord for her to accept. So she'd not even been there a week in the home of the Tidmarshes before three Awaka women had entered into a Kichwa settlement a little bit farther east of them. So that was unheard of. That wasn't something that happened often. It wasn't like Awakas communicated or had any dealings whatsoever with any of the tribes outside of Killings. Like, Killings were the main thing that was their relationship. So even the Indians that lived in Ecuador, not just the white man, were not friendly with the Awakas. And so these three Awaka women came into the tribe, and so she knew immediately that she would go to meet them. So only two of the women ended up staying, although three came, and they were both very fearful of her, she could tell when she came in. So she said she just started talking amongst the Kichwa women and just making herself comfortable there, and just trying to, like, slowly show them that I want to be your friend as well. So for some reason, the two Awaka women ended up staying the night at the Kichwa settlement, and Elizabeth wanted to spend more time with them because she wanted, as she has always, to get to know their language. So she thought, the more time I can try to spend talking with them, the better I can begin to transcribe and learn something about their language in hopes to somehow get the word of God into their language. But she knew in no way could she ask these two women to come back with her to Arahuno, because if the Awaka men kill for reasons that are unapparent, surely they're going to kill if they feel like two of their women were kidnapped. So she knew it'd be dangerous to the Kichwa tribe if she in any way took them back with her to Arahuno. So she, at that point, then had to pray, what do I want to do? Do I want to risk my daughter Valerie's life and bring her closer to the Awakas in the opportunity to spend more time with these Awaka women and know the language? Or do I want to leave and just be away? Because she obviously couldn't leave her daughter she was staying with the Tidmarshes, but she obviously couldn't leave her there. So for some reason, the women continued to stay. Each night, they just seemed totally fine staying with these Kichwa women. So Elizabeth saw that as a huge open door to say, if they're going to be here and they're going to present themselves as available, I feel like I should come and be a part of this. And so shortly after that, she went and got Valerie, and she moved them down into the Kichwa tribe that was closer. So it wasn't a week after that she'd been there that the women were down at the river cleaning, and one of the guys came out from the Kichwa tribe and started yelling, Awakas, they've killed on Norio, get out of the river quick, Awakas are coming. So all of a sudden, from what had happened, or what from this peaceful situation that they're in, this one of the Kichwa tribes comes, and it said that Awakus had killed one of the Kichwa tribesmen. And so she knew she was in a vulnerable spot. They just killed. They're all down by the river. They have no protection. She has her daughter with her. But she looks at one of the Awaka women that were with her, and she just was, like, motionless, just kind of chilling, like, not really doing anything. So she was like, I guess I'm just going to stay with you. Like, it's apparent that you're not afraid. So if I stay with you, hopefully nothing will happen. So nothing happened. The guys went on. They didn't kill anyone else. But the guy that was killed had 18 spears in him. And one of them, or a couple of them, were decorated with the New Testament. So they were sure that they'd taken this either from one of the missionaries, or from, they were sure that this was one of the Bibles that were stolen from the Tidmarsh's home when they went in and robbed it. And so there was different things that were like gifts that maybe the missionaries had dropped down to them that were all tied around the spears to like probably show some bit of understanding of what had happened. So the Kichwas were stirred because of the killings, and they blamed the white men for continuing to drop gifts to them, for building homes too close to their village, and for building homes too close. So the Kichwas were like, surely it is your guys' fault that you continue to try to have a relationship with them. Like, don't you know these men are killers? They kill for sport. It's nothing but pleasure for them to do that. And so they had a huge sense of fear and no desire whatsoever to have any relationship with them. So at that time, she knew that she was in a vulnerable place having Valerie there. So her and the Kichwa Indians who lived in that place all decided to move to Aruhuno and resettle there for a time being until things settled down. So randomly, both of the Awaka women wanted to go with them. So they didn't coax them. They didn't try. They just wanted to go. Even though they knew nothing of what was before them, for some reason, they wanted to go with them. And so obviously, they willingly accepted them to come. So when they were back in Shandia, Elizabeth was built. They built her a little small home for her and Valerie to live in. And the Waka women lived with a couple of the others. And so she was excited as much as she could to get to know as much of their language. But she said it was humorous because these two women, their names were Mintaka and Mankuma. They seemed to not be able to comprehend that they weren't fluent in the Awaka language. So she said they would just go off and they would just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. Her understanding absolutely nothing. They would just carry on these full conversations. So she said she was like at a loss. She said sometimes they would have mouths full of, what is it? It's not plantain. What's that root? It's like almost like a potato. Ah. Not taro root. Ah. Anyways, their mouths would be full of like food and they would just be talking and or their backs would be turned to her and they'd be laying on the bed and they'd be telling her all these stories. She's like, but I needed to be able to watch how their mouths moved and how they formulated words to be able to transcribe any of it. She said, so it was so difficult. But one day she said there was a huge breakthrough because one of the women said, what is that? And she looked at her and she's like, I knew she didn't know I could communicate to her what it was. She goes, and then she began to communicate to me what it was. So basically she was giving her an opportunity to learn the language. Like, what is that? And it was something obvious, like a guy, you know, doing some bit of yard work, obviously not shoveling, but you know, whatever. And so she then told her, so that was like a breakthrough in the language because they were learning to help her with that. But she said even amongst that, language process was painfully slow and she was often very discouraged. So now that she has these women here, she's like, she sees at least an opportunity to begin to know the Waka language. There's no more clear to her about how to ever get contact with them, but this is huge. I mean, this is something that was pretty big in comparison to something God clearly had to do, and she couldn't have gone out and manipulated anything of this sort. So she wanted to take as much advantage of it as she could. So one day, in the midst of her discouragement, she just prayed, like, God, please help me to understand something today. Just, like, let me be able to clearly understand something. And that day, Mankuma, one of the women, began to talk of her home and her children. And she told Elizabeth that she needed to go back and see them. She said when she left, she told them she was going to come home. And if she didn't come home soon, they were going to move downriver and she might never be able to find them again. And so she told Elizabeth, like, come with us. Like, we'll have a home for you down there. And Valerie, your daughter's going to have tons of little other little kids her age to play with. And so obviously Elizabeth sees this opportunity and thinks it's clearly an amazing opportunity. At the same time, she asked, like, won't they spear us? And the women were like, no, 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 they won't spear you. And she's like, or no, they said only the downriver people spear. So there was two tribes of Awakas, one upriver, another one downriver. And they were like, oh, only the downriver people spear. And she goes, well, clearly your people killed my husband. And they're like, well, that's because he's a man. You're a woman. It's so much different. Like, they won't kill you. And so she's like pondering these things, not knowing really the reality of if this is a safe thing or not. And so she said she knew she'd have to be convinced by more than these women. And as she And as she sought God on it, she felt like he spoke to her to go. She knew Valerie and her would go to live amongst them. Many people were against this decision for the obvious reasons. She saw no sign, no visions, and heard no audible voice, but she had the Bible, and she felt that daily it was confirming to her that she was not mistaking God's design. So she went ahead. So she knew the risk. I mean, she had a child that she was going to be taking into that area, and that was going to be, I mean, she, not just for her own life, but for the life of her daughter. And then seeing the preceding events that had happened, it was clear that this was a dangerous thing, but she really felt like God was leading her. So Rachel Saint, who is Nate Saint, the pilot's sister, was working down there. And there was a girl named Dayuma, who I'm sure you guys maybe have heard of. She traveled with Rachel Saint for a while in the States. She was an Awaka woman that fled and came to know the Lord through missionaries. And she traveled with Nate Saint's sister through the States and did different things where Rachel translated for, and they shared with people, and, you know, obviously kind of told people the stories of what were happening in, on the Ecuadorian missions front. And so, but they came back to Ecuador at that time and told Elizabeth and the two women, come stay with us for a while, for 2 months, learn more of the language, we can talk, learn, and then we'll go with you if you choose to go down there. So Mancuma and Mintaka assured Elizabeth it was going to be fine. They told her their people would accept her, and they also told her they said, we'll tell our people about God, and they'll believe in him because we believe in him. So they were like encouraging her even to say, like, this is an opportunity to share the gospel, which by no means could have been anything that Elizabeth could have done on her own. So they went down there on her own, and they said, we'll come and tell you when we can come get you. So you stay here, we'll go down there, we'll make sure it's okay, and we'll come and get you. So when they went down there and they came back, they talked to their people about her. And they found out that the Awakas killed the white men because someone lied to them. They told them that the white men ate people. And so they're thinking that there's these men that are complete savages themselves and that are going to eat people. And so it was because of a lie that they killed them. And they even said in some of them, they were sorry that they'd done it. Like one of the guys that had killed them said even afterwards, he was sorry that he did it. Like he realized it wasn't something he wanted to do. So then for the first time ever, they got insight into the minds of these people who all that they knew all these years were killers and savages. So that was a huge window of opportunity for them to learn something more about them. So they told Elizabeth they would not kill her and she could come down with Rachel Saint. So she'd been waiting for 3 years for this moment. And now that it was here, she realized how hard it was for her to make. She liked her life with the Kichwas. She had a comfortable home, Valerie had friends, and she understood the Kichwa language. She knew this decision was of the Lord and Jesus, who became the Son of Man, although he was God. So she's continually realizing these little things that she has to give up. So, you know, could you imagine you want to go, and I was talking to Ruby, and it's like there's that romantic vision of missions, and then there's the reality of missions. And it's like as the romanticism and the reality are blending, she's realizing, I've wanted this for 3 years, but now that the opportunity is laying, all of a sudden you're realizing all these things you have to lose, and part of it is just the comfort of life that you have. But then Jesus, who is God, became the Son of Man, and she was reminded, if you became the Son of Man for salvation for us, I can go into these people for their salvation, Lord willing. So October 6, 1958, they left Arahuno to move with the Awakas. So she wasn't without doubt as she was reminded of their killing. She wasn't without doubt, and her heart pondered if it was wrong to take her daughter into this. But she knew she had made this decision in the integrity of her heart before God, and she could not go back on it unless the reasons were unmistakable. So if some unmistakable reason came, so be it. But she knew she wasn't going to go back just because of fear. So it took 4 days to reach the village by canoe. And as they entered Awaka land, Elizabeth was very aware that she was entering the place of death. So these people had been killers. They'd killed her husband. And she said faith was the only thing that carried them on. Faith in the one that holds the keys of life and death within himself. So the entire tribe of the Awakas they went to was only 56 people. So it's not some massive tribe. And the oldest of them was only 45 years old. And they said he was considered lucky to be alive that long. So he was like an old man in that tribe. So 87 is not old to them, or it would be ancient to them. So somehow, although these people were nothing alike Elizabeth, they accepted her. She said they didn't marvel at her being blonde and Valerie, her daughter, for being blonde. It wasn't like this thing that they were attracted to because they were American. She said they didn't even know what American was. So it's not like they were like enamored by them. They just accepted them as they came into their village. So they gave her a room next to Mancuma's, who was one of the girls that was with her. But she said Awaka homes were nothing but a roof. There was nothing. She said they didn't know of anything of walls. So Valerie, her daughter, got like a little bamboo slatted bed to sleep on, and she got a hammock, and they got a fire. And she said there were so many times she would have wished she could have just gone and closed the door and had privacy for a moment, because everything, you're just living life in front of all these people. And so it was nothing of what she was used to, but it was a life that she accepted for the sake of hoping to communicate and learn the language so she could better communicate the gospel. She said even though there was difficulty she faced, she said she envied their simplicity, because in the summer months, or in certain months, I don't know what months, it would rain really hard, and she said she'd be frantic to try to grab her like radio and her typewriter and all her belongings that could get wet and pile them up in the middle of the place, and she said along with her clothes, and keep everything dry. And she said the Wakas, who wore barely anything, you know, the guys had like a little loincloth, and I think the girls just had like a thing around their waist. She said that they had one thing that couldn't get wet, and that was a blow dart for the guys. That was it, and they kept it up in the top of their roof where the pitch covered it. She goes, even though she dealt with all these difficulties, she's like, I envy their simplicity. She's like, and their life was perfect for what they needed down here. They weren't like at a loss, and we shouldn't have feel sorry for them because they didn't have a lot. She's like, if anything, they were living better than I was, because they had such simplicity of life down there. And so she sought to identify with the people as much as she could. And although she wasn't sure if it helped to relate to them, or if they loved her more. So she was like, she wanted to identify with them. And she was like, I wasn't sure if it helped in my like relating to them or if they loved me more. But one thing she says it, by her seeking to like identify herself as much as she could with them, it helped her to love them more, which was a huge thing. She said, it is by loving and not by being loved that we come closest to another person. She began to appreciate the necessity of removing as many of the distractions to her message as possible. Was she bringing them a foreigner's message, or had she something to offer them which would mean life, the very life of all ages? As John refers to Christ in his first epistle, if he is the life of all ages, he is the life of all cultures. So she didn't just want to give them the gospel that, or not the gospel. She didn't want to just give them the, like, take her culture and give it to them. She wanted to know that she was giving them life, which was in Jesus. And because he was the life of all ages, surely he related to them, but there was difficulty in understanding how. So she confesses to being hopelessly a foreigner, and there was nothing that she could do about it. And she felt so sheepish, despite her despite how much she tried to not be a foreigner. It was completely, you know, I mean, as you can imagine, like, she knew nothing. And she said, later on, when she questioned if she would have looked back and thought the Awakas were smart, she said, by all means, I would have said they were smart, even though they didn't have our kind of like skills. She said, but I think if they would have thought, was I smart, they would have said, absolutely not, because of how much she lacked in their culture. And so it was humbling to her to see how hard it was for her to be able to do some of the things they did. She said the Awakas, however, seemed to be very amused by her way. So it didn't really separate her from them. They just found amusement in it. And I love the story. And I read a lot, so I knew a lot more of like how she viewed them. But she said one time she was carrying a pot across. Okay, so they like to tease. That was like their form of entertainment. Like, she was like, I would see them doing things. Like, she said, like, they would, like, one, her little daughter went to, or she said she came home one time like screaming, like, one of the guys in the village told him he was going to cut me up and throw me in the fire. And but that was their way of teasing. Like, they loved to like threaten kids, like be like, or, oh, and they would wake kids up in the middle of the night and said, your daddy, I don't know why I'm laughing, I'm sorry, like, your daddy's gone, he's never coming back. And then as the kid woke up, they would just laugh and laugh and laugh. Like, that was their form of entertainment. And so she said the same guy that told Valerie that she'd be chopped up was the same guy that spent so much patience with her, showing her how to like roast a plantain over the fire. So it wasn't like there was this like cruelty. It was just like that was really entertaining for them. So knowing a little bit more of that, they said one time she was carrying a pot across the village, and so, you know, she's trying to do what they do, and she had to go down to the, she wanted to try to take care of herself. And she said that was really difficult because she had no way of hunting or planting or all these kind of things. So she was really dependent on them. But as much as she could do, she did. And they had no barter system. They didn't understand, like, I'll give you this for this. So even getting her own food wasn't like, oh, I can give you this for something. She just was basically a recipient when they would give it to her. And she said sometimes she would be hungry if they didn't offer her something. But she was carrying this pot, and she says she's walking across the village with it. And she said one time it fell, and everything poured out. And she said the community rocked with laughter. And she could hear them saying, they called her Gikari, which meant woodpecker. And she said she never figured out why. But they said, Gikari's pot fell. And they said, Gikari's pot fell? Like, other people are doing it? And they said, all of it? all of it. And then they would just roar with laughter. So they're just mocking the poor thing. Like, they don't have any sympathy for her. They just are like, she can hear them like calling across and just finding amusement out of her sorrow. So that was their form of humor, which she says that she saw their cruelty and how they treat each other one time. And they even sometimes tortured animals for fun. So she was she was aware of the cruelty of these people and how they were obviously murderers. But she said what she was most alarmed by is how they were not worse, per se, than anyone else. She said when she was down there, she would receive packages, and one of them was a newspaper that talked about the state of America, and there was, like, murders and conspiracy and bombings and these things happening. And she goes, the human condition is the same without Christ. And so we call them savages. She's like, but in so many ways, I found them better than we were in a lot of ways, morally speaking. Like, they were more advanced in certain ways than we were. Maybe not morally, but just in a sense of like how they appreciated the things they had and how they valued things. Like, they were better than us. So she really talked against the word savage. Like, is that even a right to call them? Like, maybe in our eyes, but why? Why would we call that when we have just the same thing amongst us? So she said, she was forced to ask herself when she saw the comparison, like, why was I here? What do I really have to offer them? And there was no answer but the simplest, most elemental, Jesus Christ, to obey him and to present him. So that was the continual reason why she was there. Because in anything seen by her natural means, she wasn't able to really do much. She couldn't fit in with the culture. She couldn't offer them anything. She even struggled with thinking, I'm not better than they are. I'm, you know what I mean? Like, if anything, I'm worse. But Jesus Christ is why I'm here, to obey him and to present him. So she continued to struggle with the language, and she said a lot of their words were onomatopoeias, so they were like sound words, you know, like bang, clash, you know, bump. I don't know if bump's one, but bark, like those kind of things. So it was hard to like learn how to translate things when all of them were like when so many were sound noises. So she continued to struggle with that. And then she said as they began to hold prayer meetings where Dayuma and some of the girls would, not prayer meetings, got like church meetings where they would come and try to teach them about God. She goes, but there were certain things they struggled with too, because prayer, they didn't have any knowledge of prayer, like supplication or of asking. In their language, all they would do is just tell people what to do. So they say, go get me this, do this for me. And so she was like, it was hard to understand how to communicate prayer to them that isn't just something of you're telling God to do something and therefore he is obligated to do it for you. And then they were saying, as far as son, Jesus is the Son of God. They had no word for son. It was all the same as offspring. So it was either offspring of a human or offspring of a fish or offspring of a goat. It was all the same. She's like, so we struggle to be able to communicate some of these things as in how we would want it to be communicated, how we so easily like understand it. So she realized that regardless of the language barrier, she trusted that God chose to limit himself to the human language. And she had to trust that although limited in their words, the words they did use could be used by the Spirit to show them the person of Jesus Christ, who is the living word. And in that belief that he is the Son of God, they walk as may have life. So because Jesus is the living word, and she quoted that scripture that said the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life, which is kind of a much different translation of it, not translation, but interpretation of it in communicating like her language barriers that she had, but the Spirit gives life. So she trusted the Spirit and God who reduced himself to our language could help her communicate the gospel to them. So, and she said that, there were inconveniences daily that she had to compensate for. She notes that Christ often used the word slaves when referring to how we were to live amongst the world. We are in debt. We owe it to Christ. We owe it to men, savage or uncivilized, to lay down our lives daily. Her reason for being a missionary was one of the few things she had never doubted. She knew one thing. I must obey God, and I believed this was the thing he meant me to do, just as he means other men to be fishermen, tax collectors, etc. The role seemed incidental. The goal was all important. Despite how she struggled with the language and the living while with the Iwaka people, she realized that the Iwaka were her kinsmen. And as she realized this, she also realized a new acknowledgement of Jesus Christ and all of our common need for him. So she realized that the only reason she was there was out of obedience. That was what she was doing. And so in that, she could live peacefully before God. Because if we look at our accomplishments or our perceived methods of what we can do, we're going to either give up before we need to, or we're going to be unrightly praising ourselves for things that are being done that we don't have any right praising ourselves for because it's a work of the Lord. And so she learned in that obedience was all that she really could do, and that's all that she was doing. So there came a time that she realized a furlough was needed. She'd been 2 years with the Awakas, and before that with the Colorados, and before that with the Kichwas and Colorados. So 8 years total she'd been on the field without any break. But there was two reasons why she left, and she was very gracious in her writings about this, but she said because people pressed her, she wanted to be honest. One of them was because of Valerie, her daughter's schooling. She was now six, and she said they built her a house that had walls now at this point, after 2 years of her being there. But she said it was so hard to have Valerie do her schoolwork because none of the other kids did schoolwork. She's like, so I'd be sitting there with her trying to teach her, and there'd be other kids coming and distracting, and Valerie didn't understand in any way why she had to do that. So she thought, to bring her to the States, I could give her opportunity to have school when there's a little bit of an understanding of that's what all the other kids are doing. And secondly, she said differences with her and Rachel Saint were very obvious. So that was one she was very gracious about. She didn't want to, I don't think, ever paint the picture between them as bad. But she said the village in Awaka was too small for both of them with the differences that they had. So she never disclosed what it was, but it seemed very apparent to her that God was confirming that it's okay for you to go back to the States and take a furlough and leave this work here because of Valerie's schooling and for whatever the differences were between her and Rachel. But I like that too, because it helps us show again that things aren't always perfect. Like, she was there, she was obeying him, it was clear he was leading all along the way, but then there's this difference I'm sure she was facing daily or weekly or monthly with Rachel, and eventually it came to the point that she said, okay, I'm okay to go home. Like, I feel like God is freeing me to go home, even though we could think of it and say, what, you're learning the language, you're doing all these things, don't go home. For her, she knew, like, the work here has been effective, and obviously Rachel was there. She wasn't leaving them without, but she saw it important at that time to, you know, she felt completely okay by the Lord to go home. So she's not in any way, as she writes back looking on that time, she's not in any way, she doesn't not communicate their lacks as missionaries. And she says a couple things that are interesting to me over that time. And she said, as a result of their being there, obviously huge advances for the gospel are happening with these people, and they're seeking to learn their language so they can communicate the gospel to it. But also other things were happening. She said, because there was attention on that land, and tons of people in the States knew that the tribe was being, that there was beginning to be more focus on that land, and people started coming down just to get oil, and they were exploiting the land for oil. And then she said, even because of the different people that were coming down, some of the people from the tribes were getting polio and becoming crippled or dying. So she was seeing these things as very real effects of their being there, and she struggled in her mind to think, is it good what we're doing or is it bad? Like, we're doing this work and we feel like it's the Lord, but at the same time we're seeing evidences of our being down here is almost allowing people to hear about this land and come in and do things that we would never have wanted them to do. We'd want to protect them and keep them in this perfect little quiet world until they learn the gospel. And even after that, have them know the gospel and just keep on living the way that they know. But she said, there's a temptation to focus only on the good and ignore the bad, or to greatly tell of the bad and ignore the good. She remembered Jesus and how by his birth, many children had to be killed. He had a very humbling death, and many of the closest to him fled. She learned how unhelpful it is to be judgmental. The sovereign God moves in mysterious relation to the freedom of man's will. Sometimes the light rises excruciatingly slowly. The kingdom of God is like leaves and seeds, things which work silently, secretly, slowly. But there is in them an incalculable transforming power. The missionary, with all of his sin and worldliness, stands nevertheless with Christ for the salvation of the world. Every time her hopes were dashed, she asked to exchange her small view of good for God's view of it, expressed in Romans 8. So she obviously was challenged, and I love in her, every time she's challenged, I love it because somehow she brings it back to a greater biblical picture, I think, that we all need, because that's what I think one of the biggest things that I think I learned from her is she's challenged constantly by real things that are coming against her, and she's not unreal about her challenges, but she's real about stopping and seeking and trying to get the big picture of the Word of God to see how she can bring that into the present circumstance she's dealing with, so she's not in despair and she's not in inflation and pride. Like, there's always that struggle that we face. So Rachel Saint ended up continuing the work with the Awakas until 1976, when she moved to Dallas and continued to work with the Wycliffe Bible translators. And according to Elizabeth's last report in 18, 1981, five missionaries were with the Iwaka helping with the translation of the Bible into their language. So the work continued on there, which was so sweet. And then in her words, she says, since then, this is from her website. You guys can check it out if you ever want. She says, since then, my life has been one of writing and speaking. It also included, in 1969, a marriage to Addison Leach, professor of theology at Conwell Seminary in Massachusetts. He died in 1973. After his death, I had two lodgers in my home. One of them married my daughter. The other one, Lars Gren, married me. Since then, we have worked together. So I don't know how much younger Lars is than her, but you can tell by the pictures he's much younger. Not much, but he looks now like he's probably in his late 60s, and she's so sad looking at pictures online because she just is so old now, and I don't know what you want. I guess we don't want death, so that's the sad part. We want to ignore that part. But yeah, she's 87 years old now, and I don't know when she got dementia, but she has dementia. So she spent much time, I'm sure you guys knew, like teaching and going and doing different, I think she even came here one time.
Yeah.
I know there's pictures. So yeah, I don't know how long ago that was, but, and then there was something called Gateway to Joy, which is like a radio broadcast that she did weekly and just did different things. And she's written tons of books that are really sweet because as you guys have seen, her perspective is really whole and she seeks to be very biblical. And I feel like she's talented in linguistics. So she has a good way of writing. And that's really sweet. But I think, yeah, in all of it, I think it's clear in her life, as I said, like she really did learn what she taught me and what I think is evident. She learned to wait. Like that was something that you could tell was so hard. But what I like about her is she's honest about the struggles, but in no way in reading her story am I tempted to not trust God more. If anything, I'm tempted to trust him more, even though she's like so honest about the pain and the difficulties and the reality and the struggles. It doesn't hear that and think, gosh, who's that God you serve? If anything, it's the exact opposite where you hear that and you're like, Lord, yes, I would like to obey you to a greater fashion because you are worthy of that. Not because I think it's going to equal a life of a picket fence and, you know, whatever, your kids in the backyard and having, you know, all these things, but it's going to equal a life that we want because we know who you are. And so I really liked that about her, that she was so willing to be honest. And yet at the same time, it drew us to a greater understanding and a greater desire to follow the Lord. So, Valerie's husband was a pastor in Kentucky, something on the East Coast as well. Well, I know Kentucky's not East Coast, but you know, East. So she was, I don't know, I didn't read any updates, but I know that after she got married to him, he became a pastor somewhere and she worked. Yeah, and she only had one child her whole life.
Isn't it unusual that the women would leave the tribe and come back and there was no problem mm-hmm. with them integrating with other tribes?
And that was a mystery too. There are unique people. One thing she said too, she said when they came back, it was like, it wasn't even like, they didn't like greet. They had no greeting whatsoever. So it wasn't like, hey, good to see you. It was honestly like nothing had happened. Like it was just like, well, she didn't go with them there because they went back alone. But they visited another tribe and one lady said, I haven't seen this person for however many years. And it was just like, they came and she said they didn't even offer them anything for like an hour they'd been there. So they were an interesting people, but absolutely like so amazing just to think.
And no retribution or anything.
Yeah.
Because women usually don't have a role of leadership mm-hmm. or anything, or they usually know and control women.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, unusual that it was just like, oh, well, they're gone.
Yeah. And when the women had gone back into the tribe, Elizabeth flew over the tribe with in a plane, and she said she didn't see Dayuma, which was the one that was gone traveling in the States. So she'd probably been gone for years. So Elizabeth said in her heart, she was scared that they'd killed her because she was like, the fact I didn't see her. And I think Mancuma was the only one. She didn't see two of the women. She's like, so her fear was like, they'd kill them. So she was thinking like, gosh, they're either not going to come back for me. And this whole thing went down the drain, but then they end up coming. And so yeah, even Dayuma, who'd been gone for years, didn't have any retribution. It seemed a very easy, natural transition back in the land. And so, yeah, I think what is so great is that aspect of it. It's so hard for us, but, and I think she learned it from Amy Carmichael, to be honest, because she wrote a biography, Elizabeth Elliot wrote a biography on Amy Carmichael, and I know her life influenced her a lot. And Amy Carmichael said that, like, when you don't know what to do, do the next thing. That was one thing that I read in one of her books. And that's what Elizabeth said, that when after Jim died, she's like, I didn't know what else to do, but the next thing. And the next thing presented herself on the mission station, and there was tons of work to be done. And I think through that, God seemed to lead clearly into these things where we are like, whoa, you're with them, like from point A to point B. If you just see the two, you think, how is that possible? But for her, his leading was great, subtle, but by just her doing the next thing and then seeking him when bigger open doors came. And one of the things I thought was like, it was evident to her when the door was closed with Jim, she had to wait on the Lord. And then when the doors were wide open, she had to wait on the Lord to see if it was him that opened it or if it wasn't something that she should walk through. And so that's why I like her life of waiting, because it seemed like whether the door was closed and she was learning, God, you've closed this, I can't open it, I have to wait on you. Or the door was wide open, like all these opportunities she got, but I don't want to walk in it in any way, you know, flippantly if this isn't you that's opened it. So, yeah, she seemed to be very considerate in how she sought the Lord to make sure she walked through.
Did they ever make contact with the tribe that was killing people, or you said that there was
The downriver. No, the only thing that was said about that was that they said the downriver, they were like, well, why do you kill the downriver people? Because they started to get into like the reasons why they killed, like they killed the white men because of a lie. And they said they killed the downriver people because they killed their people. So she was like, so it seemed like retribution in that sense, where it's like, well, they did this to us, so we're just doing it back to them. So there wasn't even, because they always wondered, why do these people kill? And so it seemed like in some degree there was an explanation, although the explanation maybe didn't have a strong roots or help in it, but that was why they said they killed them, because they killed our people, so we killed their people. That was kind of the bottom line.
Did they ever get together?
Not that I've ever heard. Not that I read, I should say. There could be evidence of that, but not that I read. Because they seemed to be the same tribe, but they, or the Wakas, they were all called, but they were definitely separated by.
Did they ever find out why they came and raided that house?
No. Mm-mm. But I think, I'm totally putting my thought into it, but I think it was just because they did think they were probably trying to put fear in them. If they thought these men are eating people and they had that kind of like story going around them, and their home was close to their village, maybe they were like, if we do this, at least it's going to slow them down or stop them or whatever. So, because they said that guy Honorio, where they killed, he was a Quechua Indian, and they said, I can't remember why they said they killed him. Yeah, I don't remember why that one was, but it seemed like all of their things like were like, oh, well, we heard this and we did this. And I think that killing was so a part of their history. So it's not like they heard, oh, maybe we should think about killing the guy. I think since killing was a very natural part of their tribe, it was very easy for them to kill someone. I don't think they had guilt and all those things of like, you know, oh, we shouldn't have done this. So I think it was natural, but I don't know if the reasons were as backed up or as, I don't think the stories that preceded them of them being these savages and those were as true as they thought. I think it was just that killing was natural because it was a part of their history. But usually they had reasons for it, but sometimes the reasons weren't as based in reality as much as someone lied and they were like, well, let's kill them then. You know, that's just what we do. So, yeah. Do you guys have anything else?
Wasn't the son of one of the men that killed the missionaries, didn't he get saved?
The son of one of the missionaries or
the son?
Yeah, and oh, there's another cool thing. Yeah. Yeah, he came too, and he was traveling too. And there's pictures of Steve Saint, who's Nate Saint's son, traveled with him a lot. And so they did a lot of work together. And one of the crazy things too was when Valerie, the little girl, they knew who the killers were. And so when Valerie like saw them, she related the Awaka men's faces to her dad, because that was the pictures, all the pictures she'd seen of her dad, there was usually like, you know, there was these Awaka men. So she said, is that my dad? Like the first time that she saw one of the Awaka men, and Elizabeth said at that time, I had no clue how to tell her, no, but that man killed your dad. She's like, so I didn't. So, but anyways, to answer your question, yeah, he did. He did get saved and he was traveling in the States and everything. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. there's a lot of work that was done amongst them that is brilliant. And that's what they said too, like the amount of people that were stirred up because of these men being killed was huge too. So it's by no means that there wasn't effectiveness of that. It's just an interesting thing. And Steve Saint went on to do a lot. Like he was a pilot himself, and he tried to build like that flying car, but like not just to work in America, but like to be useful out there. Do you guys ever hear that? And then he got like paralyzed. It was so sad. I was looking into him not too long ago, and he got paralyzed because it hit like one of the rudders, like hit his neck. And I think he's gaining strength now, but it was like a pretty tragic thing. But he for years was working amongst the tribes in Ecuador and stuff too. So I love how there was so much connection, you know, with all of them, you know, like they still were wanting to continue on with that. So
my pastor's father-in-law was friends with all those people.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
So he like knows him. He has the propeller in his garage from the plane.
Wow, from Nate Saint's plane. Mm-hmm.
He has the exact propeller.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know that Missions Aviation Fellowship's a sweet thing. Like how they really, I mean, they do things that could never be done. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was a crazy thing too. I mean, even about them just getting, like they said Nate had to be so skilled that like if anything happened to his plane, he had to be able to find things in a jungle to repair his plane. Like, so if the wheel broke, he had to be able to use the natural whatever, you know, terrain to be able to find things to fix his plane. So you had, and even landing on that beach, they had to like measure it and map it, and you had to be very skilled in those things, or else if you're trapped in a place, you might not be able to get out as a pilot. So there's a lot of things that were dependent on your ability to do that. And they were building a huge thing. Was once they established someplace, they would build a runway. That was huge. So once they built a runway, it was like, okay, now we have an actual place they can land. But until they were down on the ground and established, a runway usually wasn't built. So that took time too. So, yeah. Anything else?
When the missionaries went to Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
they brought the measles, and that just devastated the natives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The illnesses, but it worked both ways too.
I know.
When men went to Africa, malaria was, I mean, so many of them died before they even got to do anything.
I know. It's so hard because you just want, I want things like it's bad or it's good. Like, oh, that was wrong because they got malaria. Oh, it was good because of this. And sometimes you can't, you're challenged. Like she said, I can't be judgmental. Like you're like, oh, so hard. Yeah. So.
Even in the breeding, it's like a lot of people said, oh, those guys died for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people thought that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And that showed like that was like almost the stamp of failure instead of like the beginning of something new. That was like, well, clearly they failed. And yeah, and she said she got so many letters of telling like them why, like what they did wrong. Like, oh, they did this wrong and they did this wrong and this is why it happened. And so, I mean, yeah. Yeah. And I love that. I mean, it's obvious like the work of the Lord cannot be thwarted. So it's obvious that like, these things like God uses, or what she say, like how she said it was so well. The fact she used the word like manipulate in God, I was like, oh, those seem so opposite. But like he works these things, and none of his plans can be like not work. Like whether it's a walker or a missionary, whatever, like that he is doing it. And so, yeah, we stand humbled in that. But yes, so that is Elizabeth Elliott. I'll pray, and you guys are done. Lord, thank you so much for the goodness. And we continue to pray for whatever work is going on amongst any tribes that remain in that part of the region of this world. Lord, we know many prayers have been lifted up to you because of this story. And we know we want to continue that because you say you have not because you ask not, Lord. So we ask that your word would continue to prevail amongst the tribes in Ecuador and whoever is unreached in that region, God, for your name. We pray for Steve Saint. God, I don't know his condition physically, but we do pray that you would be with him, that he could continue, because I know you've given him a great mind to use, and he is centered on you, and he wants to use it for the continuation of your gospel to go out. So we pray for him. We pray for Lars and Elizabeth as they're both still alive today, and Valerie and her husband, Lord, that your word would continue to be communicated, that they would be lights in this world, Lord, and that the wisdom that they've gained from these experiences would be communicated to all of us who do not have these experiences but can grow richly because of the knowledge that they have. So we love you, we thank you, and we praise you. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Enjoy your evening. You're welcome.
I want to ask a question.
Yeah, so let me push pause.
I mean, stop.